This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. Today we are introducing a two-part episode on the language of cancer with Dr. Liz O'Riordan and Dan Wills. Liz is an expert within the cancer community, having worked as a breast cancer surgeon before being diagnosed with breast cancer herself. Liz is now an accredited, trusted information creator, which means that when you listen to her podcast or watch her videos on YouTube and social media, you know you're receiving information you can trust. We are also joined by Dan Wills from the Patient Information Forum, or PIF, which is the body that awarded the Trusted Information Creator status to Dr. Liz. If you've been diagnosed with cancer or you have a loved one with cancer, you will know how confusing and difficult it can be to find the right information online, and crucially, to know what sources you can trust. So in this first episode, I'll be talking to Dr. Liz and Dan about how we should go about looking for information and answers, and whether or not we should ever consult Dr. Google. In the second episode, which will be released the day after this first episode, Dr. Liz will be answering some of the most common cancer questions, helping us to understand the jargon and debunking a few myths along the way. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks for having us.
So, Liz, we'll start with you. You came on the Breast Cancer Now podcast in 2022, and our listeners can find that episode in the show notes. You talk a lot about your breast cancer diagnoses and your history as a breast cancer surgeon there, but a lot has happened since then.
Yeah.
So firstly, I wondered if you could just briefly introduce yourself, your books, your podcasts and your work.
Yes, I worked as a consultant surgeon in Ipswich Hospital from 2013 until 2015 when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And my experiences led me to write a book because I bought 10 books written by patients. I didn't know what it was like. So I wrote The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer to kind of put everything in one space. And that led to me doing videos on Instagram and YouTube to explain breast cancer, which led to me doing a podcast where I answer listeners' questions called So Now I've Got Breast Cancer. And when I had to stop work, it was another way for me to help people.
And you also have your memoir, which you published in 2023.
Yes, I never talked about my mental health as a doctor. And off the back of COVID and the pandemic, when doctors were sharing their histories of breakdown, I thought, I'm not embarrassed that I was suicidal twice as a consultant doctor. The stress of telling 10 women a day they've got cancer just eats away at you. So I shared what it was like as a woman in a man's world, learning how to become a surgeon, and then what it was like ending up on the other side of the table. And that's called Under the Knife.
Fantastic. And it is a brilliant memoir, which I would highly recommend to read. Could you tell us about your breast cancer diagnoses and how you went from being a surgeon to that?
Yeah. So firstly, I never checked my breasts because I'm a breast surgeon. It's never going to happen to me. I'd had a couple of cysts. I thought I had another one. And that cyst turned out to be a 13 centimetre lobular and ductal cancer. I was 40, no family history, fit and healthy. And I had chemotherapy, a mastectomy, radiotherapy, tamoxifen, the full works. And I realised how little I knew. 2.5 years later, I was going to have my implant removed because I had chronic pain after the radiotherapy, and a nodule of scar tissue on my chest wall turned out to be a 2.5 centimetre local regional recurrence. That meant more surgery, more radiotherapy, having my ovaries removed, going on to aromatase inhibitors. And then last year, the day before my memoir came out, I noticed a little red spot above my mastectomy scar, and that was a second local recurrence. So after surgery, I'm now on palbociclib and Faslodex bum injections for life to hopefully stop it coming back a third time.
And how are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm struggling with the collateral damage, the side effects. The fatigue is exhausting. The bum injections aren't nice. Your hair thins, your eyelash thins. And it's very hard not to be miserable all the while. But you get up and you put one foot in front of the other and you think, well, I'm still here. I can still help people. But it's hard. You have tough days, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you had to leave your career as a surgeon because of your cancer.
Yeah.
And you've now developed a new career as a leading voice and expert within the breast cancer community. Why was it important to pivot to a career that's completely different and yet still serves the same purpose of helping people with cancer?
So I was forced to retire after my first recurrence. Side effects for surgery meant my arm didn't work. I couldn't operate. And I was lost. I've lost my income, my purpose. I'm a doctor. I couldn't be a doctor again. I didn't know what to do. And writing and talking about my experiences was another way of helping people. And also getting my ego stroked, because I missed that as a surgeon. And I realised I can put a video out on YouTube and help 2,000 people in an hour compared to the 100 women I would treat a year. And my nephews think it's crazy that I'm now a YouTuber. But it's a really rewarding way to explain things really clearly and try and fill that gap between what the doctors tell us and what we're desperate to find online.
Would you want to go back to being a surgeon if you could?
I really miss it. I really, really miss just helping people and that sense of achievement, having women flash you in the supermarket to show you their breasts. And just, it was creative, it was intellectual, it was everything. And I wish I could go back, but this feels like a pretty good second best.
Surely you still get women flashing you in the supermarket now?
Not so much. I do get asked for selfies at airports though, which I find very strange.
All right, well, moving on to Dan. You work for the Patient Information Forum. What is that and what's your role there?
So the Patient Information Forum, or PIF, is a group of organisations that originally got together over 25 years ago, and they share best practice and help other information producers produce better quality information. 4 years ago, we launched the PIF TIC scheme, which is the accreditation which Liz has gone through and multiple other organisations have gone through. And my role is to run the PIF TIC scheme and assess everybody that goes through it.
Well, that's actually what I was going to ask you about. So the reason we're bringing the two of you together here today is that Liz has recently been accredited as a trusted information creator by PIF. So could you both tell me a little bit about how that works? Dr. Liz, was it something that you had to apply for?
So I knew of another GP on Instagram who was doing the PIF TIC homework, going through the process. And I thought, oh, I want a part of that. There is so much misinformation out there, and it's really hard to prove that what you're saying is accurate. So I got in touch with Dan at PIF TIC, and I thought, I've got a lot of work ahead of me, but I really think it was worth it.
And how does it work from your side, Dan?
So the PIF TIC has evolved quite a lot over the short time it's been going. So it was originally a scheme for charities and organisations to go through for their websites or their printed literature. As time's gone on, and really driven by COVID, as people have started to kind of turn to people like Liz and YouTube and the social media sites they're used to, we felt that we had to move to that as well. So Liz went through the pilot of what we're calling the individual PIF TIC, if you like. And what we've tried to do is to go wherever people are going to quality mark that. So we look at the process that people follow rather than the information that they produce. And that then gives us the quality of whatever you produce, whether you do it at midnight, 3 o'clock in the morning, during the afternoon. We don't have to see it and slow you down. We can be confident that you're creating it, whether that's an individual or a large organisation like Breast Cancer Now.
And what process do you have to go through? Was it, did you have an interview, an examination?
It was, I had to fill in an application form going through how I create my videos. And you have to prove that everything I produce is backed up by my peers. So colleagues would agree that what I'm saying is correct. It's evidence-based. It's factual. It's not some rubbish that you'd make up. That I'm diverse. And it's very easy when you're talking about breast cancer just to say women, but anyone can get it. So remembering that everything's accessible. You put the alt text when you're using images, making sure everything is clearly captioned, that every 3 years I will go back and check everything I've put out there to say, is this out of date? Then I will change it. I'm using jargon-free language. So every single thing that I put that tick on has to prove it matches all of those criteria. And then people like Dan can come along and do spot checks in a year or two and say, actually, you've not done that. We could take the tick away.
And is the tick only for people in medical professions or who have qualifications?
They have to be supported by somebody that's got that. So one of our criteria is a medical expert has to vet that information. So you could be a medical expert yourself and author the information. That would be fine. If you're not, then you would need to get somebody to check that as part of your process. We look at things like Liz was saying about how accessible is the information, because that's really, really important. That was something, again, that came out through COVID, was unless you were white middle class, the information probably wasn't for you. So we put a lot of emphasis on the language that you're using, the terminology that you put in there, things like the alt text that Liz was saying, but also making it friendly and approachable and clear to people. We know the reading age in this country is quite low. It's kind of between 9 and 11. And if you go to see a healthcare professional, their language is probably much higher than that. So how do we bridge that gap? How do we make sure that you get information that's not just accurate, but that's understandable. And I think that's something that the PIFTIC does really well in pushing people to understand what that means.
And the alt text that you mentioned is the text that says, so if you see a picture of a woman wearing glasses, then it says underneath it, picture of woman wearing glasses for people who can't actually see that image.
Exactly. So for Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, it will say that, which is something I didn't do before because I was just lazy and didn't have the time. But then you realise I'm not being truly accessible. And
yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's one of the beauties of the PIFTIC scheme is that we're not here to catch people out. We're here to help you create better quality information. Yeah. And hopefully I'm sitting quite close to Liz on the sofa. She agrees that we did it in a supportive way. Yeah. It isn't an audit like you would assume an audit would be. It is a much more friendly Zoom conversation around where you're going, supported by the application that you send in so that we can see what you're currently doing and where we might be able to guide you in looking at different options. We do not have a perfect process in mind that we force on anybody. It's about understanding the information that you create and how we can help you to create it in the best way for you.
I'm interested because I'm a linguist and a communicator and you're a doctor by training.
Yeah.
Have you found, was there a transition between trying not to be jargon heavy in your explanations of things? Or is that something that's always come naturally to you?
It didn't come naturally. And I've got a PhD as well. So I was used to writing paragraphs that had like 500 word sentences in them. And it was only when I started writing a blog when I was diagnosed and writing for the Daily Mail, I learned how to write for the general public and how to explain statistics and maths in really simple terms. I remember being asked to write a piece for the Times. They said, you can take it up a bit. Great. And I started writing about genetics. So they said, no. Can we go back to traffic lights, please? And actually, it's really enjoyable learning how to write things that people can understand and come back to you, because we know you remember nothing that a doctor says. And I was a doctor and I remember nothing my own doctor said to me. But it does take time and effort to learn. They don't get this word, they don't get that word. And the analogies that I may use may make no sense to anybody listening and just stepping back. And it's also hard to get in criticism because you think you're perfect when someone says, actually, that made no sense. That was my best work, and try not to take it personally and always be able to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we are diagnosed with breast cancer, we're usually given a huge wad of leaflets and information from the hospital, which we inevitably take home and leave to the side and never return to, or we might sometimes read them. I certainly have used the internet when I have a new symptom or side effect, and it often results in scary information. Should we use Dr. Google? And if so, are there ways for us to use it more safely?
The internet can be very useful if used correctly. I think there are a lot of things that are on there that, like you say, are scary. On our PIFTIC website, we do have some top tips for how to highlight trustworthy information. So there's some really easy things that you can look for, like, is there a date when something was published on there? Is it in a language that you can understand? Are we trying to hide behind medical terms or jargon? Could you get the references if you wanted to? All those kind of things help you to kind of pinpoint this looks like it's a reputable source. There's great things like the PIFTIC that you can see on there. There's Health on the Net on there as well. So there are some guiders that you can kind of look at. But the key things are, is it in plain language? Can I get references? And do I know when it was created? If people are upfront and show those, that's a good indication that this is a trustworthy piece of information.
Yeah. Where's the source? So many people make crazy claims and there's nothing to back them up. I went to Google. It's the first thing I did. The day after my biopsy, I was looking at metastatic blogs in the middle of the night, trying to see just how bad it could be. And there is so much more breast cancer content out there now. And I think it's great being able to talk to other people. But I think it's a bit like TripAdvisor. You often hear the people with the worst side effects shouting the most and don't see most people are actually fine. Mm. And it can give you a very, very skewed world. I think now the accuracy of your content is based on how many followers you have. If you have 1 million followers in America, like there's a woman out there now saying mammograms are dangerous, thermography is the way ahead, don't have them, they'll kill you. And she's got 1 million followers. People believe her because she has 1 million followers. And you've got doctors trying to break through and it's really, really hard.
I think that's a really interesting point, is that the volume of people doesn't indicate the quality of the information. When we were looking at the PIFTIC for individual content creators, we reached out to quite a few that had massive followings. And a lot of them were quite honest and they were saying things like, we would put something in there that sparked controversy to bring people in. And then we would tell them, and that's not what we're about. We don't want that out there. We'd much rather you have 100 viewers and it all be accurate than 10,000 viewers and it just not be great. I think one of the other downsides of the internet is the longer you look on there, the more likely you are to find the answer that you want that might not be the true answer. Because when you get really scary news, you want the bright side of things. So you will just keep looking until somebody agrees with you. What we're trying to do with the PIF tick is make those places harder to find. So you'd have to look further into the internet and they don't pop up as early, because that's a real concern of ours is people want this as an answer. Where do I go to find it? All that forum, that will do. I'll just agree with what they're saying. And that probably isn't the best advice you could get.
It all comes down to what you put into Google. So there's a thing called the Dutch test that analyses your urine to look for hormones. It's not, there's no evidence. It doesn't work. You have to go through 5 pages of Google to find the one scientist who has debunked it completely, because they bought all the other ads. And if you say, does this work or do I need it? Google will tell you what you want to know.
But no ordinary patient is ever going to know that. No. Like that's scary, you telling me that, because unfortunately I can't give this podcast with you saying that to everyone in the world. And
no,
most people aren't going to know that. So
that's why in my book, The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer, we had a chapter based on how to understand trials and research to try and give you an inkling to say, is this true? Do I need to spend my money? Just try and stop back and say, nothing is 100% accurate. When all these say, we've had no failures. Well, that's rubbish. Mm. They used to say, as a doctor, you're really bad if you haven't had a complication because you haven't done enough. But we're all, it's that sense of certainty and hope that you're looking for that you get so gullible. And it's hard trying to get the information out there that there are trusted creators that you can trust, and hopefully more of us will grow and make it easier.
And I think YouTube are doing a really good job of raising those good quality people out there with their health shelf and stuff like that. Mm. Again, PIF were quite involved in creating that. But I think anything that anybody can do that tries to lower the bad quality and raise the high quality is really useful. And like you say, the general person on the street probably won't know all of these things. So keeping things really simple, like looking for the dates, is it in a language that I can understand? Everybody can kind of get those, and hopefully that will start putting people down the right path.
And a lot of these people have got spending huge amounts of money on people writing the copy, the content, the marketing. Mm. Like when you go into a shop, everything you want to buy is you go in and turn right. They've got the money to spend to make a hook to draw you in. They've got huge amounts of money and time, whereas most content creators don't. And that's why they're so, they draw you in, don't they?
Yeah. And I've had a lot of conversations with content creators, and they've all tell me a similar thing. It's, I'd rather make 3 really good videos a year than 150 videos that weren't worth creating. Mm. Yet you'll find those that are churning 3-4 videos a day out are the ones that are getting the views. And they're probably not the best researched things.
I think it's really important to say that high number of followers does not equal trustable.
No.
And because people can buy followers.
Yes.
Through bots or whatever.
I get 20 requests a day. Would you like, give us 50 grand and we'll give you 100,000 followers. And I don't want them. They're bots. I want engaged people. But we're all shallow.
Yeah.
And but actually a good way to figure out whether what you're following, if it has a high number of followers or if they have a high number of followers, is to look at the engagement. So if you look at the comments and look at the type of comments, you can tell very easily whether a comment is a bot. It's like, I love your profile, please follow me back or whatever.
That's a great tip, Laura.
Whereas if we go on Dr. Liz O'Riordan's Instagram and we look at the comments, they are always people saying, hi, I've got HER2 negative cancer, it's realistic facts which relate to what you've just been talking about. And I think that is a good way to tell whether an account is real or not.
And I think the responses that the content creators give is another really good one. A lot of them that have gone through the PIF tick or that are creating good content are normally quite happy to respond and share really insightful things in the comments back to people. Those that are just spouting, they can't answer those awkward questions. They don't know it to that level. So again, I think your comment on looking at those is really important.
Dan, is there a list somewhere of all the trusted information creators like Dr. Liz so we can know we're looking at reputable sources?
Yes, on the PIF tick website, there is a directory of all of them. It's in alphabetical order and it's broken down into therapy areas as well for people to look at.
Okay, well, we'll find that link and we'll put it in the show notes. And if we're looking at Instagram, where would we see the green tick on Liz's profile?
Maybe not just yet. It will just depend on when people have time to create a new piece of content. But it will be embedded in people's videos. It could be in the notes of things. We give people flexibility to where they want to include the logo or the text that explains what the PIFTIC is. We don't like to dictate anything to anybody. So some people might want it in their video. Some might want it at the end. So you may see it. You may not until the end of the video. That's up to the content creator where they feel it's best positioned.
So I think another Dr. and I on Instagram, we're planning to put it in the corner of our cover posts on Instagram and YouTube so you can see that and then it'll come up through the video. But it's making sure all the new content ticks all those boxes. Mm-hmm. And it takes me 8 hours to script a 10-minute video.
Wow.
To make sure it's fact-checked and it's easy to read and it's understandable. So it's a lot of time to do. But you'll see the little green tick on the white background.
And what is to stop someone from using that green tick who does not have the... the accreditation.
Good question.
So we police the use of the logo through various methods, Google image searches. We've got quite a lot of people out there that are part of the scheme and they look at it. To give you a bit of an idea of how that works is I used to work with NHS England on the information standard and their logo should have been removed from everything when the scheme ended. I still now get people contact me going, have you seen this website? Have you seen it's been put here? Oh, there's a new version. So we're well aware that people are policing it for us as well, which is great. They've spent a lot of time and effort like Liz has to get it. They don't want it on something else. So internally we do it, but all of our members are very responsive if they see it cropping up somewhere new.
And Breast Cancer Now is PIF Green Tick
accredited. Yes, they are. Yes.
Fantastic. What does the charity have to go through to be able to...
It's a very similar process, but we ask slightly different questions around how they create information consistently, because it's not one person always. It could be a team. It could be different people. People change their job roles. So there's a lot of how is the process documented in that consistent way. And what they've started to go through now is where we are doing that kind of random check-in with people. So after you've been with the scheme for 2 to 3 years and your processes are where we would like them to be and where you would like them to be, we start to actually look at examples of your information and make sure that you have followed your process. Because one of the key issues is we might have a lovely process, but no one follows it. So we check that people follow that. So we're looking for all the same things that we've looked at with Liz, but we look at slightly different things in terms of what if, let's say, Dave leaves and Sally replaces him? How would that work? So there's things around induction and consistent processes.
Okay. Other than Breast Cancer Now and your own channels, Dr. Liz, what other resources or sources can we trust for breast cancer information out there?
That's really hard because there are so many. And I think it depends what information you want to get. There are now more and more breast surgeons and oncologists coming on Instagram talking the truth and combating myths. There's Asghar Nushka, there's Dr. Tasha. There are quite a few of us in the UK, and it's kind of how you find us to do that. Generally, the big cancer charities, breastcancer.org in the States, you can trust. And most patients are telling the truth. I think it's when you get wellness influencers or people outside the cancer space coming in and sharing their experiences, you have to take things with a pinch of salt. And I think, especially in the menopause space as well, that's very controversial. If there's no proof, if there's no evidence to back up their claim, I think you have to take things with a pinch of salt. And remember, patients, we're all extreme. We all show the best or the worst on Instagram. So any scary thing a patient says, just try and take it with a pinch of salt.
I think two areas that there's a problem where things are evolving constantly and official information is changing constantly. It's really, really hard to get the right information. And as you said, Dan, that's one of the reasons why checking the date on something is... a good thing to do, because you might be finding an article from 15 years ago that actually is no longer correct, but was correct at the time. But with things like menopause and nutrition, there really are so many different bits of changing information all the time, aren't there? And it's very, very hard to know who we
can
trust.
There are different schools of thought who believe different theories, whether HRT is safe, and we don't know whether testosterone is safe, and women are terrified that they're going to die of heart disease because they can't take HRT. And it's really hard to get the voice of common sense and guidance across the UK and America out there. But we're trying our best.
Mm. It's particularly hard when there's so, you know, since probably 2022, 2021-ish maybe, there's been so much, suddenly so much information and publicity and open talking about menopause in the UK especially. But when you are a breast cancer patient, or you have had breast cancer, or you have a breast cancer family history, all of that information is slightly different for you, isn't it? So What were the, so other than, I know you share information about breast cancer and menopause, but are there other resources there that we can use?
So I did an episode on that on my podcast with Professor Anise Mukherjee, who is brilliant. She's a consultant endocrinologist who's had breast cancer herself, and she's written a book, The Complete Guide to the Menopause, and she's a great resource. Professor Joyce Harper as well. And we are saying HRT is not recommended for anyone with breast cancer because it can increase the risk of it coming back. And HRT is not licensed to reduce the risk of any disease. It's only licensed to help the symptoms of menopause. And there are so many different things you can have now apart from that. And it's the same with diet. There are 10,000 cancer diet hits on Amazon UK. There is no cancer diet. You just eat what everyone should eat, a healthy plant-based diet with a rainbow of fruit and veg. But we're desperate. And someone will say, oh, God, I get trolling for saying sugar doesn't feed cancer and you don't need to cut sugar out of your diet. I get the most trolls and death threats for saying this because of people out there. And it's really hard to kind of combat that nonsense.
We are going to talk about that in your second episode.
Brilliant.
So if people stay tuned, I'm going to be asking you about whether sugar feeds cancer. But I just want to touch on what you just said, which is that you get trolls and death threats.
Yeah.
What?
It's like the cults with COVID and the vaccines, and people believe what they want to believe, and it's tough.
You can, of course, hit the report button online whenever you see an account that you know is sharing information that cannot be trusted, that is absolutely not correct, or who is trolling, or who is sending abusive messages, etc. So do use that.
It is
at your disposal.
I would say never reply. It is not worth engaging with people who are being nasty or spouting rubbish. Just let it slide. It's not worth it.
I have seen you online quite a lot debunking, if that's the right word, what other social media wellness influencers or whoever have said. Why is it important to you to, because what we will often do is, so-and-so has said this is the actual truth.
Yeah.
Why is it important to you to share the real truth?
Because these people have a massive following and people will believe them. And if they think mammograms are dangerous, they won't go and a cancer might be missed. They might actually come to harm. And as a doctor, it's do no harm. And I don't care if you don't have a mammogram, but I want you to know why you should and shouldn't with actual right information, rather than just calling them out. And I'd rather take the time and say, actually, let me show you, this is why. But it's hard because people don't like it and all their followers come after you. But you think, I'm going to help somebody who will think twice and say, oh, okay.
One of the things a lot of people Google, perhaps because they're afraid to ask their medical team, is how long they have to live or what's their prognosis. If someone wants to know that, and not everyone does want to know how long they have got, where should they go for that information?
Doctors will never tell you because we often get it wrong. And I've told patients they've got weeks and they've lived years and the family are really mad. And I've said you've got years and they live weeks. It's really, really hard. But to get a rough idea, if you don't have metastatic cancer, what your survival is, there's a website called NHS Predict, which you can go on for free. And you put in all your individual tumour factors and it will tell you what the benefits of treatment are to keep you alive at 10 years. If you've got metastatic cancer, there is no accurate way of knowing how long you have. It depends on how your tumour responds and everyone is individual. And for me, I would obsess over how bad my numbers were, but I kind of realised it comes back or it doesn't. It's out of my control. All I can do is live my life the best I can and take one day at a time. But it's, you cannot get that one specific answer for you, because there are people who eat and drink and smoke and don't exercise who are alive at 100 and fit people like me who are dead at 30. So it's, no one can give you that answer. Mm. But the NHS Predict website is good for anyone with primary breast cancer.
Is NHS Predict what oncologists use as well?
Yes.
Or do you have your own behind
the
scenes?
No, so every breast MDT in the country, so every surgeon and oncologist will put everybody's data into NHS Predict. And this helps us determine whether to give chemotherapy, Herceptin therapy, hormone therapy. And for people who are borderline for chemotherapy, we use tests like Oncotype and Prosigna, where that's molecular genetic profiling of your cancer, to find out the benefit of giving you chemotherapy.
MDT, is that multidisciplinary?
Sorry, it's me using jargon. I get told off by Danny. Multidisciplinary team. So whenever you have a diagnosis, a team of radiologists, pathologists, breast surgeons, breast care nurses, oncologists, radiotherapists, sometimes plastic surgeons, sit in a room and discuss all the cases, metastatic and primary, that week. So when your team see you, they have a plan that's been approved by everyone in that room on the latest guidelines, on the latest evidence. We know what trials to offer.
If a patient wants to get a second opinion,
yeah,
are they within their rights to do so?
Yes. So firstly, if you don't like your team, you can change. I'd rather someone say, you're not my cup of tea, I want to move. You can get a second opinion, but the question I would say is, why do you want it? Do you want someone to tell you what you want to hear or someone to tell you what you need to hear? Because I went to get a second opinion when my cancer came back. I was like, who do you see? I know most of the oncologists. Do you go to the Marsden? Do you go somewhere locally? And if they say no, am I going to see a third or see a fourth? So really think about, why are you getting a second opinion? Go and have one if it puts your mind at ease. But if you're going to see a third and a fourth and a fifth, then you've probably not come to terms with your diagnosis.
And if you don't say that to your doctor's face, understandably, that you would like to yeah. ask someone up, because I don't think I would dare. I'm a people pleaser and I don't like
it's
to
tough.
Hurt people's feelings. So I wouldn't want to go up to my oncologist and say, would you mind if you refer me to another oncologist? Is there someone general that you can contact at a hospital?
The breast care nurses are generally pretty good because they all know the dynamics and they know there are different characters and people you didn't get on with. And they're a pretty good way of doing it. Or your GP. And say, actually, I'd like to see a second opinion. The problem with a second opinion, though, is that can add another 2 or 3 weeks to you getting treatment, as that team have to go through everything. But your GP is a pretty good place to start.
Dan, are there any red flags we can look out for online to identify when we're reading something that's not to be trusted or not Ooh. Reputable?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the reverse of what we said earlier, if they're not putting dates on there, if there is a lot of jargon or common grammatical or spelling mistakes, that's normally a red flag that this has been created very quickly. If they can't back anything up with reference sources or an expert that agrees with them, I think if you look at social media, going back to the comments that we spoke about earlier, if they just blank any direct question, that to me is a real red flag if they can't give you that level of information. And I think going on what Liz was just saying, if they can't give you that balance, I think there's an issue there. Most healthcare professionals that take it seriously will say there is this bit of an unknown, or I can't tell you this for these reasons. That's normally a good indicator. If someone is like, no, this is it, this is the only way, probably a bit of a red flag there as well, I would say.
If I find a new doctor on Instagram, for example, you mentioned lots of oncologists yeah. and surgeons are coming onto Instagram now. Should I be able to find a website for them? Should they always be findable online with their credentials and everything else?
So you can check the credentials of any doctor with a GMC website. You can find out they have a number, they're registered, but we don't need to have websites. Some doctors will because they have their own private practice, but it takes time and money and energy and effort to do all of this. Mm. And often they're just struggling to put videos out in their own time. So you may not be able to check. And actually, the flashiest websites are often the people who've got more money to spend, but actually aren't doing much, but we're shallow. you trying to find a carpet cleaner. Oh, that's a flashy website. They must be really good. And actually, they're terrible. But the local guy down the road doesn't have a website. So that's irrelevant when it comes to doctors.
I think going back to what we were saying about the comments and stuff, we've seen a lot where one good content provider or doctor will explain about somebody else, or you might follow yeah. on and see this. There is a community. If you're not in that, then you're probably out of it for a very good reason. And there are others like Liz that will point the finger at people and say, you know, what you're saying isn't right. You should find them quite yeah. easily.
And actually just podcasts, because people are taking clips from podcasts and you assume that what we're telling you is the truth. But you are under no obligation to check what we're saying is right. And a lot of podcasts are talking to people who are just spouting rubbish, and that then becomes a clip on Instagram. And because mm-hmm. the podcast has got millions of followers, oh my goodness, this must be right. And it's actually just having... Is this taken out of context? And has anyone else said this? And do they agree? Yeah.
So one of the other things that we do with the tick is we vet who do you link to. So it's not yeah. just you as an organisation or as an individual, but whenever you're signposting to, working with, doing any of that kind of stuff, how are you comfortable that they are of good quality? So everybody will have their own vetting criteria, but it tends to be around the same thing of, can I see where you back this up? Can I see how you understand your target audience? So when you were saying earlier, you know, is there anywhere else that we can go? We work with all of these other yeah. organisations, and they've all got a very specific target audience that might be different from Breast Cancer Now or from Macmillan's. And it's understanding where they overlap and they work together, and supporting each other is really important. So we're not saying, you know, you must have one website that does everything. It's about, if you can't answer it, where would you signpost to answer it, or a follow on? Because a lot of people will have one condition and then something else as well, yeah, a secondary yeah. one.
We were talking about podcasts then. Podcasts are not policed. They are not. There are no regulations around podcasts as far as I know. So no. You do have to be careful, she says, doing a podcast. You do have to be careful what you hear. And I think actually there's one particular piece of information which I'm still not sure what the truth is. And I know, Liz, you've talked about this. One is about the use of vaginal estrogen yes. for people with hormone yeah. receptive breast cancers. And there are podcasts that say it's fine. And then they're on, for example, my oncology team says it's not okay. And I know, I think you might have said you can do it.
Yes.
I think I tend to want to hear maybe at least three yeah. professionals say that a thing is okay before yeah. I'm going to believe it. So not necessarily because I've heard it once on one podcast.
Yeah.
Am I going to go against what my oncology team is saying? Yeah. Does that make sense?
And that's quite a thorny issue we can probably get into in the next edition, Bern, but yeah.
Yeah.
And okay. I think that, again, is a sign of somebody that you can trust, because they're saying, I've got this opinion or done my research to say this, but I'm comfortable for you to question it and yeah, go and yeah. find other people.
Yeah.
Again, going back to those red flags. If it was no, listen to me and only me, that's a real red flag of somebody yeah. that's probably not saying what they should.
I absolutely agree, yes. But yeah, definitely some safety in numbers in terms
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I think so.
Hearing it from not just one source, but several.
And I think with new things like that being introduced, most doctors and oncologists are incredibly risk averse.
Yeah.
I don't want you to do anything that might increase the risk of your breast cancer coming back. But on that note, I'm not telling you not to drink and to eat a healthy diet or to exercise. It will have a much greater impact on the risk of recurrence. So it's that we are very scared about cancer coming back, whereas the evidence is changing that the risks aren't as much as we think. Mm. But when there's a debate, you've got to know who you're getting your information from.
Speaking about new developments, we often see online links to articles, links to research papers,
yeah.
which are written in jargon-heavy
yes.
Spiel, yeah. whatever the word is. As laypersons and patients, how should we go about reading these things?
Well, it can be really hard because often they're behind a paywall. I think if the post telling you to go look at this research says may, might, could, then you can forget about it because right. it's years and years away. And if it's in an animal model, in a cell, in vitro, then it is not being tested in real humans. And often people are saying, oh, but they looked at breast cancer in mice and they gave them a massive dose of this drug and it cured the cancers in 10 days. So we should all start taking this tablet now. I think, no. So if it's might, could, may, should, and it's talking about an animal study or in a lab, then you can ignore it because we are 10, 20 years away from it becoming a thing.
That's really, really useful to know. Thank you. Finally, a question to each of you. What is the one thing you would like to see change in terms of cancer diagnosis, treatment and beyond in the coming years?
I think something that's really important is that patient choice. You being able, so like you were saying earlier, you'd like to see it from three people rather than your team at your hospital. I think that's something that's really important, that people can get access to that information and make a choice that's right for them. Because like Liz was saying, not everybody is the same. Mm. You'll have some people that are healthy, some people that are interested in their diet. You'll have others that are like, actually, I know I might only be around for another 5 years, but if I had treatment, my lifestyle is going to change and I don't want that. But without that good quality information that you can trust, you can't do that. That's something that I'd like to see.
I think coming off patient choice, I'd like trials to be open to everybody wherever you are, off the back of COVID and all the virtual technology and more research in metastatic cancer patients. We need more quick access to drugs and everyone should be in a trial just to try and help. I think there's too much on prevention and the biggest risk factors of breast cancer are being a woman and getting older. And I think we need more money to help all of us stay alive for as long as possible.
We're going to take a break now, but please stay tuned for our next episode where Dr. Liz will be answering the critical questions you've always wanted to know about cancer and busting a few myths. Is it true that sugar feeds cancer? What does it mean if your cancer is grade 3 or stage 3? What even is cancer and when will there be a cure? We'll be answering all these questions and more in the next episode. But for now, a huge thank you to Dan Wills from the Patient Information Forum and to Dr. Liz O'Riordan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. Thank you.